Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 31st, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Samuel Torvind. Today he will be continuing his series on An American Jordan. Today's session number is 3 and is titled Cultural Forgetfulness and the Thirst for Roots. Let's listen in.
Samuel Torvind, An American Jordan. The Culture of Forgetfulness and the Search for Roots. Little, please come in. With water, how appropriate. Are you going to water?
Yes, I am going.
Part of our dog and pony show today. I talk for a while, so Nick comes in and does a water routine.
That's right.
Wonderful.
Water washed, spirit
warm. Water washed, spirit
warm.
She collects all of these and then arranges them. That's Sonia's duty here at the villa.
Flower lady.
Some of you have not been to this session before, so I'll just say who I am. I'm Samuel Torvind. I'm on the teaching staff for this week. And most of the time I sit in an office at a computer and edit books and other things like that. And once in a while teach part-time in the Twin Cities area. Some of you are familiar with that area. Probably about 75% of the people who are here are familiar with that area. But it's nice there. I live on the river, and I like that. It's a water area, more than 10,000 lakes, and we have this lovely creek back here, which frames our discussion. During this week of conversations, I'm asking us to engage in a discussion about the culture of baptism. And by that I mean, if we reflect on baptism, the way we became Christian, what does it mean for us today? What do those actions by which we became Christian mean for us today? Sometimes I think we don't think that way. We might have been... How many of us are baptized as infants? Okay, got it both there. We may witness baptisms, huh, on Sundays. And of course, many times, since we tend to be nostalgic about babies, I think there's a way in which our perceptions of baptism, especially infant baptisms, can be kind of cute. In the sense that we don't realize that the language we use and the actions we perform really deal with life and death issues, because that's what baptism is, a life and death issue. The question then is, when we witness a baptism, do we reflect on its ongoing meaning for us? And so part of my task is to say, let's try and think about this, or think about this, or reflect on this, and not forget this. The other part of the discussion is that always takes place within a cultural context. Baptism always takes place within a cultural context, ours being North America at the end of the 20th century, which is much different, I would say, than North America at the beginning of the 20th century. How is it that the cultural character of the place and time in which we live influences us as individuals and as a church? And does our baptism, or does the culture of baptism, have anything to say about the culture in which we live? You with me so far? Mm-hmm. Making sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Susan, would you be so kind as to close that door? I can't stand a single distraction. Who am I quoting? I'm quoting her on the first day we came. Remember? Okay. So yesterday we spoke about the individual and how Americans value the individual and how, oh boy, we are into, yes, can't read that. how we not only value the individual, but we perceive the individual in American culture in a way that is much different than many other cultures. We all almost attach a sacred character to the individual. We talked about briefly about the historical sources, some of the historical sources which led to the valuing of the individual, at times almost to the exclusion of the community in American cultural life. And consequently, we discussed, and we will do that again today, the tension between any individual and a community in which they exist. That will always be there, that will never go away, and that is a necessary and a lively tension. What I want to get at is when there's an imbalance, when a community becomes tyrannical, or when an individual is exalted far and above away from a community, so that the individual stands in isolation or the community becomes totalitarian, on the other hand. And you might think about that yourself. When you think about life in general, does anybody think about life once in a while? I mean, I know people that don't. No, honestly, I do, for a variety of reasons. They are working so hard, they have no time for a reflective moment. There are people who just don't care. They love ignorance, and they enjoy not thinking about the quality of life and the meaning, the purpose of life. When you do that, and let's all assume we all do that once in a while, do you begin with yourself or do you begin with your family? Do you begin with the community in which you exist? Or does it depend upon the day or the time of the year? It's a rhetorical question. Just think about it. My guess is that most of us begin with ourselves. The first thought is not, let's say, the church community in which we exist. That should be a little indication to us of the valuation of the individual in our society, because that is part of the cultural air that we breathe. The other question that goes with that is there a fear? Is there a fear that propels a singular pursuit of individual autonomy in our society? Is there a fear that propels a singular pursuit of individual autonomy? Is there something that lurks within the mind, a fear within our collective cultural consciousness that pushes us to emphasize the star, the individual, the maverick, the lone ranger, above any other kind of way of looking at society? Any ideas on that? You know, a real quick way to get a read on that is just to think about movies.
Sports.
On the one team, we have team sports in the United States, and we value team sports, and we know that a team has to work very diligently in an interdependent way. And at the same time, our athletes have now, they're just not great sports people, they are stars. Mm-hmm. And when they move into star range, a couple things kick in, don't they? The athlete has to have a publicist. Lawyers to negotiate the contracts.
Bodyguards.
Mm-hmm. All kinds of things. So on the one hand, we have a kind of interdependent notion of a team working together, and yet in our culture, which is so, and we're going to talk about this tomorrow, so yeah, I know you want to come back. We're going to talk about the culture of entertainment and what the culture of entertainment, what the pervasiveness of that and how that affects us as well.
What about the politicians? How they emerge as singular persons with a
more, they would see often die for the benefit of themselves, the enhancement of themselves, rather than the common good.
This fear that lurks, that might lead us to this, I'm thinking about, I don't know, it would be different in other cultures, but the basic fear is really the fear of non-being, that we would cease to be somehow unless we put forth great value on ourselves. And even, I was talking to a friend of mine about what it takes her to get through the week. Well, she works out four times a week, so she has a personal trainer. She has a great body. She has a therapist whom she sees only once a week. She has a chiropractor who adjusts her. She has a person who does her hair that no one... I mean, it was sort of the sense of this whole community of service... This is just a regular person. Service people are needed to support her individual self.
Uh-huh.
Well, before I would get too judgmental, I would have to say, I have a network of people around me that I use, in a sense, give me a deep sense of being, that I am rather than that I am not. So I wonder if the fear might be that we would cease to be, that we don't, we're afraid we would be swallowed up by a community and not known. It seems to be an identity question.
I think that's why monastic communities in this country, in which the community maybe 65% of the time predominates over the individual, why Americans from their Anglo-Saxon, Puritan, Protestant origins tend to look askance, or they're just bewildered by monastic communities that vow to live in one place for the rest of their lives. They will never leave that place. It would be as if one were going to stay at Holden the rest of one's life and never, ever leave.
Oh, God.
I know that. But I think they're... Now, here's a living example of how fear can provoke us into the evaluation of the individual. And, of course, the task that we deal with is the balancing of those two, the balancing of them. Another piece, I listed all these things I want us to talk about today. The other piece that goes with the value of the individual is what I would call segmentation. Segmentation. It's a term really that comes from marketing techniques. And what is segmentation? It is a marketing or sales strategy by which a given population is separated into various groups or segments in order to achieve the best possible results. You with me? The big question is, what distinguishes people from each other? What are some of those characteristics that distinguish us from each other?
Age.
Oh boy, I got that.
Popping right up there.
Age.
Gender.
Sex.
No, wait a minute.
Gender. Color.
Gender, yes. Sex, no. Race.
Yeah.
Economic. Okay, so socioeconomic.
Geographics.
Cash on hand.
Okay, geographics.
Cash on hand.
So kind of plot that down with the socioeconomic.
Education.
Language.
Increasingly in our country, yes, language. What is it in Los Angeles? 65% of the population is, for the primary language is Spanish. Anything else? Well, that covers a pretty wide gamut there. And we know the way in which, well, let me just give you an example. A friend of mine is the head of systems at a large Minneapolis newspaper. Well, there's only one, the Star Tribune. I will give out the name. And he said, He says every subscriber to the paper is on the computer system,
yeah.
and the name is there, the address is there. And he said, for instance, he said, I actually went in and looked up your address, your zip code. He said, you're in a really tony part of town.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it doesn't say that I live in an apartment and I don't pay a mortgage of $2,000 a month. Either. They said, we can get that information, and we can get even more information by buying information from other companies that have information on you. So that, he said, in the future, when newspapers are just not sold as one newspaper, we can actually customize the newspaper for what you want, and we will have a customized profile of every customer. I said, you mean like as much information as the IRS has? He said, even more.
That's scary.
And part of that part of it is scary, but part of it is the segmentation in order to target you and me. Certain companies will call up the paper and say, okay, we want to get a hold of all the 40-something white males with an education of more than a master's degree who happen to live here, da-da-da-da-da, because we're going to sell them retirement plans or something like that. And they'll be able, just like that, to say, here's the list. Okay. Well, we might get nervous, all right, about all the information other people have on us. My point is to say, what happens when we are segmented in such a way so that the characteristics that are so obvious to us are used to target selective groups for advertising sales and to maintain customer loyalty? The question beneath it is this one. Advertising offers signals to a person that he or she is directed into acceptable stereotypes or segments. In other words, advertising offers signals that you are should rightfully see yourself within a certain segment of the population.
Victoria's Secret does the same.
Victoria's Secret. and in what way?
They do exactly what you just said, only, I mean, they do it for advertising their clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when you get that catalog, you know that it's because of
something,
where you live, your age, or whatever.
Your credit,
all those things.
Okay, so the catalog comes to your home, and the catalog silently says, you belong here. You belong here. You don't belong. You don't belong with the Penny's whitewash sale.
Yeah.
Crap. Well, no, but I mean, with every promotion, something else is denied. You see the point about how you are led into seeing oneself in a segment of the population. Now, of course, that ability, or that strategy, better word, that strategy is now being picked up by churches. It's now being picked up by churches. Cards on the table, I have real problems with using that methodology, or using that method. There's a very large church outside of Chicago. It's called Willow Creek. And people who are interested in church growth and making bigger, better churches tend to go to a place like that because they have 425,000 members, or I think it's like 17,000. But it's huge. It's a small Minnesota town. And recently, about 3 weeks ago in the New York Times, there was an article written by a professor at Harvard Business School saying, if you want an example of quality management, go to this church. They have learned how to do a superb soft sell of Jesus Christ. How did they do that? They used the market segmentation techniques and a little bit of psychological analysis, cultural analysis, to come up with the conclusion that all of their services on a given Sunday or Wednesday should be geared toward 40-something, 50-something white males. Why is that so? Because their research told them, and they agreed with it by doing this, if you get men in, the little ladies will follow.
They were featured on a documentary, either 48 Hours or,
yeah,
or Prime right. Time, not too long ago.
Right. Okay. So there are churches that are already using it in that, I would say, kind of sophisticated way. But there are other churches that do that all the time. I mean, how many of you are familiar with churches or attend churches where you have a contemporary worship service and a traditional worship service? That's what we're talking about here, is market segmentation of your congregation. What does that do? It simply splits. Susan, please.
I just have a great story about this.
Okay.
Several years ago, I saw an advertisement on television. It showed a woman about my age driving a Subaru station wagon with small children in the car in the rain at night on a curvy road. And something came out in front of the car. She stepped on the brakes and, you know, her kids were safe and she was safe. Well, I was telling my friend about this. I said, the people who wrote this ad know everything about me. They know what I fear the most. They know I'm just old enough that night driving, rainy night driving, is scary, that I've got babies, that I want to feel safe and independent. I want to both be able to go out without my husband driving, and I want my children to be safe. And this person said to me exactly these words. Our church is looking for people just like you. We are organizing our church to satisfy the fears of people just like you. And what she was saying was, are you raising children? Do you worry about keeping them safe? Do you want to be independent and yet confident? This is our church is for you.
Right.
And so it was exactly that same thing. What do I fear and what do I need? Mm-hmm. You know, it was very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't think she'd spoken to the Subaru people or... I can't remember if it was a Subaru ad or Michelin tire ad, but it was she was in a station wagon.
Probably Michelin, probably Subaru.
But isn't that interesting? So that's exactly what you're saying, the segmentation. The segment that they want, what she wanted to say is, you would fit in our church.
Right. And here's the big problem. It's only your kind of person that they want. Mm-hmm. Now, what's the Pauline insight concerning this? Do we know the chapter from Galatians? Mm-hmm. You have died in baptism. There is neither Jew nor Greek, male or female, slave or free. Well, he got most of that right. Not the slave or free part. What is the Pauline insight? The Pauline insight comes from an understanding of why he wrote that and to the kind of community he wrote that. Where are the Pauline churches located? They're largely in urban areas, in heterogeneous populations that included Romans or Corinthians, Asians, Africans, men, women, a variety of religious groups. In other words, Paul is writing to people who live in cities more like Seattle and Los Angeles than Salt Lake and Northfield. You with me?
Uh-huh.
Okay, and the question for Paul is to recognize, first of all, the distinctiveness of every human being. The distinctiveness of Samuel Torvund, it certainly comes from his parents and the way he was raised and the experiences of his life, but theologically we would say, biblically we would say, the distinctiveness, the uniqueness of my personality, the uniqueness of Sonia, of Christian, all of that comes from God. In other words, the uniqueness, the particularity of me, of you, of you, of you, is remarkable because it is given to you. It is the imprint in a particular way of God's presence. The problem is, in society, so many times, what distinguishes us from each other, which is given us by God, becomes a source of divisiveness from each other. Capiche?
Mm-hmm.
What is distinctive of us, that I'm a male and many of you are females, in society many times becomes a way in which we are divided from each other. And we have a whole history of the church at times agreeing with that. Yes, males by nature and by God's decree are superior to women. But you know what? We have for 2,000 years, and now we just happen to be at that point where we have to give it up.
Yeah.
And we're caught in the middle right now. So it's going to be tough in any transition, you know, big paradigm change. It's going to be rough for a while. Okay, so Paul says, you've got all this distinctiveness. How can that distinctiveness be honored in the community of the church without becoming a source of division?
Parts of the body.
Parts of the body. So he says in baptism, my paraphrase, in baptism, we die to the impulse to let our distinctiveness become a source of divisiveness in the community. And we begin the process of dying to a worldview which says we should be separated from each other, we should be exclusive. We begin the process of dying to the impulse that says we want only Susan Briels in our parish. And if there is a woman who happens to be black or Asian, she is not welcome, even though she fits all the other criteria that Susan was talking about. So my suggestion is, the language of inclusivity that we use today is simply a new way of saying something old. And the intuition about the inclusive nature of the church, it's not just, you know, decorating on the cake. It is of the substance of what it means to be a Christian community. Now, do you see how if we take that seriously, which in and of itself, I would say in any congregation or parish, in and of itself is an enormous task to commit oneself to. Why? Because the effects of original sin are everywhere, and we're always going to screw it up if we nonetheless see ourselves as people who are committed to that. That in and of itself is going to be a protest to those elements in our society which would like to see us in the church and in society itself segmented or divided from each other. Segmented or divided from each other. You see the subtle way in which we say, well, we're going to have contemporary worship at 9 and traditional at 11. What's the stereotype that goes with that? The stereotype is that these two will be at the contemporary service and those two will be at the traditional service. Hmm? Young people want to go to the contemporary service, and old people want to go to the traditional service. Yes, when we talked about market culture, we said one of the effects of a market culture is that you can never be out of date. You can never be out of style. You can never be old-fashioned. Why do cars have new bodies every year? Why do fashions change every year? Why does the advertising change every year? It's in order to get us to buy a new product. But the subtle message is, if you don't, you're going to be out of style. In other words, you're going to look old. And there's something wrong with looking old. It's the sin of ageism. It's despising what is old and getting older and saying only what is new is appropriate, is good, is morally good. That's why I think there are problems when we divide our congregations, one from the other, based upon superficial, stereotypical styles. Why is that such a problem? Because we're much more interesting than those stereotypes. We're much more interesting as human beings than those stereotypes. I was at one meeting at a publishing house in Minneapolis in which a vice president came and met with a certain team that is responsible for worship and music resources and said, you know, we've read through all of the surveys and only 3% of the population ever listens to classical music. So, okay, what we have in classically sounding music, let's put that aside and start out with the I just want to praise you, I just want to praise you, I just want to praise you. And in fact, the surveys were placed in front of us. 3% listen to classical music, 72%, this is not correct, listen to country western music, 12% listen to jazz. Okay, it's all this marketing that's been done along those lines. And so we were told, well, now, here's the new manifesto, let's get going on this. And I said, thank you very much. The person left, and my old pal from PLU, Norma Ahmet Nelson, said, if this is the case, I don't think we should be here anymore. And I said, it's not the case. Why? The data itself is inaccurate. The data itself is inaccurate. I listen to classical music, I listen to jazz, I listen to soft rock, I listen to country western. The data never asked what all the preferences were, only the first one. Do you see the problem? So when we use marketing techniques in the church in order to segment people from each other, I'm saying we've got big problems, because many times we're using superficial marketing strategies or evidence. Do you see how that is a truly baptismal problem? How it's a truly Eucharistic problem? Okay. The other thing that goes with it, and I'd like to move to that, are any comments on this? Do you have a question?
Too complex.
Ask it and we'll do it afterwards. Go ahead.
Make explicit the baptismal problem.
Yeah,
I just don't relate this to baptism at all. I don't know where I am.
Oh.
You say this is a baptismal problem?
Yeah, I think it is, in that it's a baptismal problem, because in baptism we say who we are. We enter this community. Part of baptism is entering a community. We're united to Christ, but we also enter this community. And the question is, what kind of community should we be? I'm trying to suggest that the Pauline insight is that we should be a community that does not play favorites and only wants one particular or four particular type of people to come into it. When we begin to use market techniques that say, well, we just want to target the 20-something young mothers, or we really would prefer only to have white people or people like us in our community, we have to a certain degree contradicted what baptism says the church is.
It's similar to being in a congregation in a large city, in a city, and there's a struggling Lutheran congregation, but they are now surrounded by a Hispanic, maybe, and a black
population,
and you want to bring, probably I'm using the wrong words, hope and the gospel to all people, to your neighbors, but we don't want them in our church.
Yeah.
That's very sad. We don't want them in our church. So you die. That's what you do.
The church dies.
The church dies. We don't want them in our church. I mean, this happens a lot. And I think, is that part of what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Because they're not like us.
Now, you see...
But I also think the age, you know, I love the idea that the child and the grandparent can be together in a worship service. I mean, that's all I want to say. That's what I think part of that is about.
I think to explore...
Because I'm baptized, and because of what I am as a child of God, I should want my black neighbor or my Hispanic friend to sit beside me who's baptized. We are a different community than the world or the marketplace. Mm-hmm. We have to be a different community.
Mm-hmm. That didn't...
Forgive me.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that that was the philosophy of the 60s. When we had, specifically in the Minneapolis area, we had riots in the late 60s, 66 and 67. The thing was that we, in the other churches, should include, become a melting pot. Everybody joined the church regardless of their color. But that whole thing went away because everybody in the last 30 years are going searching for their own roots, and now they prefer their own congregations, although they were all invited in at one time, but it didn't work. It never worked out that way. Now the churches in that area prefer to have their own congregations, and they're growing, and some of the others are dying out, but they want to be in their own ethnic group.
I would ask the question, why do they want to be in their own ethnic group? Because my guess would be, although it's difficult to speak in specific examples, or maybe I'm speaking in generalizations, my guess is that there are great challenges when a homogeneous population in a church begins to think about welcoming others into it that would make it into a heterogeneous, a more diverse population. And there are ways, subtle ways, in which an established church can give signals to newcomers that they are welcome or they are not welcome. I mean, I see that, for instance, simply in the way people dress.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if the clear signal is you need to be financially successful so you can afford these kinds of clothes to be in this parish, it does give a signal to those who do not have that.
There's also a way to look at that from the other side, and that's for the last 30 years, those of us who are good white liberals have said to the African-American community, the Hispanic community, come join us, be a part of our organization. And what happens, I think, in that invitation is we're saying, come be like us.
Yes.
Come join our agenda.
That's right.
Come work on the issues that are important to us.
Yes.
Instead of saying, oh, can we come join you? What's important to you here? Let me work with you on that issue that is important to you. And so I think often that's where we fail as good white liberals, because it almost becomes this marketing of segmentation, of saying, well, you're black, but you can still come and be just like me. Mm-hmm. And that's, then that also becomes mm-hmm. rejected because that community doesn't want to necessarily be like me. Mm-hmm.
And I think it really, many times the proof of the, in the pudding of your point is when it comes to leadership. Mm-hmm. Who will lead us? Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're real happy in our parish to have black altar boys, but I'm not sure about a black pastor. Mm-hmm. Or Hispanic. Or vice versa.
Yeah.
Just the opposite. Yeah. I worship in a black parish in St. Louis for 4 years. For a variety of reasons, but the point I'm trying to make is when it came time, it was a parish run by a religious order, Catholic religious order. When it came time for a new pastor to come in, a new associate to come in this predominantly black parish, people were very, very reluctant to have a white priest come into the parish. Well, did we have a hoedown of a conversation for quite some time over that? Because it can go both ways. And it came down, in the end, to this very question. What does it mean to be baptized together into one community? And is that not part of the great baptismal struggle, is to see the difference of the other person, but not as a source of discrimination or division within the church itself? Let me say something about, just lead us into this little conversation about forgetfulness. That's the title of our talk today. But some people said, let's look at segmentation. We didn't get to that yesterday. Part of the foundation of our country, I would suggest, is the desire to be forgetful. It is the desire to be forgetful in this sense, that in the foundation of the country, if one came here, one was able to forget the past. For so many people, it was a terrible past. You know, when our immigrant forebears came here out of famine, or when they came here because they were unemployed, or when, in our family, we've talked about our relatives who came here. One person came and began to work, and others came with the knowledge that they would never return to their native land, the great sacrifices they made in order to live. Much of that was forgetfulness of the past. For others, it was the need to forget discrimination, or living under an oppressive ruler or government. So we can say, on the one hand, forgetfulness is to our advantage. Hmm? That when one came here, one always came with a promise that you could start over again. You with me on that? I mean, I think the ability to start over again is also ingrained into the American consciousness. And we can see that geographically, can't we? That when the East Coast became, quote unquote, too established, people came to the Midwest, which then they meant by Ohio, and gradually proceeded to the plains. But when that in and of itself became established, one could go even farther where?
West.
Here, to the West. That one could start over again geographically, but also one could start over again personally. Part of the difficulty with that is that in the American character, there's a profoundly, I would say, ahistorical tendency. And there's also, in the American character, a kind of a, not universally, but at times, an anti-intellectual sensibility. So that people who want to think, and they want to think critically, and they want to think critically about the past, are wasting their time. Because that's water over the bridge. It's done and gone with. Why would anybody ever want to study history when the value that we give is to the moment and to the future? Why would anyone ever want to do that kind of work, to look to the past and think critically about it? I mean, it's over with. It's gone. It's done with. I was with friends of mine recently, and one of them was talking about how important it is for her to be able to trace her family origins, to do the family tree business, and even to go back to Germany to find out where all of that comes from. And her husband turned to her in this kind of offhanded way. He sat there and he said, oh, just let it go. Just let it go. First of all, I'm going to have to pay for more trips to Europe. He said, what's the point of it? Who cares? That's all over and done with. We're here, we're now. Just let it go. Of course, this only fueled her desire and her steadfastness to pursue it with even greater vigilance. But do you get, that's a gross caricature. But I think to a certain degree, it speaks about the divided way in which we view our history. It can be of value or it can't be of value. The other thing is, you have to ask why, when totalitarian regimes come to power, why do they first suppress or eliminate the artists and the historians?
Because the mistakes of, as an instance, the mistakes of World War I led to World War II, and it's only by knowing the history that we can avoid those mistakes, but we don't always do so. We didn't look at the French experience in Indochina led to our being involved in Vietnam. You talk to any politician at the time, he did not even understand the history of the French in Indochina. Mm-hmm. He knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm. I think the other part of it too is that there's a subversive character to the study of history. Because a historian can say to the emperor or to the president or to the parish leader, you know, it's been different before. It hasn't always been that way. Things have changed. What you're insisting that we do has been done before and it failed. In other words, there's always a way in which the historian is almost like the jester in the court, who says, before you proclaim that this is new, maybe you should remember that we tried that 20 years ago.
The war in Bosnia now is not new. It's World War I all over again.
That is right. That's right.
But you made a comment just a minute ago about why do they eliminate things. I think of China and they completely wiped out, and of course there's things coming up out of the ground that they're finding, but they wiped away all of their art and all of the beautiful things. They broke all the vases and they totally wiped it out. Why did they do that?
I think, it's imagination. I think the other part of that is to say, why did one wing of the Reformation completely wipe out the visual arts? The most radical wing of the Reformation, not the Lutheran Reformation, but the most radical wing of the Reformation said, there can be no visual arts, there can be no arts. It's a way of cleaning house. That's part of it. I mean, there are other theological or biblical arguments that go with it, but part of it is it's a way of cleaning house, of starting over fresh. Why, when one group of monastic communities broke off from the Benedictines, did they say there will be no pictures, there will be no stained glass, there will be no statuary, it will simply be pure white walls? It was a way of cleaning house, but in the cleaning house, you see, that's a symbolic act. It means more than one thing. It says, we will be as pure as the walls that surround us. We want to be as simple as the walls that surround us. That's what reforming movements many times, or big changes in structures tend to do. I think that's part of it too. Today we find, though, among many younger people, and I think at times older people as well, the notion of history begins with me. In other words, history begins with my birth. And anything before that, I don't even either know what it was or really has no significance for me, because the moment is of the essence.
So you know what we say? That was before my time.
That was before my time, right. Do you see how at times there is this predilection in our culture to view our past as inconsequential? And can you see that on the other hand, there's a certain value in it? That's part of what confession and absolution is about, isn't it? I can confess the sins of the past and I can be forgiven of my sins so that the past does not need to haunt me. The past does not need to be a burden that I have to bear. I don't have to constantly return to Pharaoh's house to be accused of my errors. I can leave that place and go to the promised land of forgiveness. I can start over again. There is a part of that in our own liturgical culture, in our own sacramental sense, yet that takes place within a larger history. And I think that is the important thing to remember, that with our forgetfulness, with our disregard, our cultural disregard for the past, an outcome of that is we have a sense, can have a sense of rootlessness. Mm-hmm. If I don't want to remember the past, or if it doesn't matter to me, part of that leads to the point that I don't care where I came from. And what happens when we don't have a sense of where we came from? Are there any parents here? Any parent care to share what happens when a child does not have a sense of where he or she came from?
It's chaos. It's chaos if you have no roots.
And why is it chaotic?
Because we need to be connected.
This whole movement of adoptees searching for their roots, I think it's a prime example, the need for them.
Isn't it interesting that now we see the rise of historic preservation societies in the United States? Mm-hmm. I think my mother once told me that we are a very, very young nation, given the nations of the world. We are very young. And there are times when I've thought, the character of our country is really that of a 17-year-old boy. What's a 17? It sounds kind of insulting. I don't, 17-year-old boys can be wonderful, but when they're wacky, what are they like? Headstrong, I don't care about the past. I want to be out on the move. I want to have a good time. I've got some money in my back pocket. I've got the car. I can go out and cruise around the town. I can do whatever I want to. Do you see there's a way in which at times Americans are perceived that way by other countries? That we've got too much money and we're too young.
And we're arrogant. We don't think we can lose. That's changed some in the last 20 years, but there's still a sense that somehow we're indestructible.
Right, and that's the point, you see. That's the other point. We're never going to die. 17-year-old mortality? What are you talking about? I'm going to live forever. And in 20, 30 years, all of a sudden that begins to shift. Let's come back to this, though, to rootlessness. The other part that goes with that is a sense of incoherence. Not only do I not know where I came from, but there's an incoherent sense about me. I don't have a point of orientation in life. Now, I can have a point of orientation in life. I can know where I came from, and down the line, I can say, I don't agree with it. But at least I have something to deal with, rather than not knowing where I came from. I would say that is a piece, an important piece, a current that runs through the American character. Look at the hero movies, all right? So many of our hero movies speak of the individual who comes in, does something heroic, and walks off the scene, does not return home, but walks off the scene.
Susan.
I was going to say, if we don't know where we came from, a couple of things happen. We don't know where home is. Mm-hmm. So we don't know, we don't know how to go home or how to make home. Secondly, if we don't know where we came from, we begin to believe that we are self-made, that we just sprung up by our own volition and our own brilliance and strength, which means, I think people without roots are people without gratitude. You know, I've known very, very bright people, who are so disdainful of their parents, because their parents are, uneducated, blue-collar folk. But these very, very bright people don't understand that there's a kind of genetic thing that happened that helped them be very, very bright. So they're very disdainful of their parents. And there's no gratitude. So people without gratitude and without roots also have no, can end up with no sense of responsibility to anybody else because they sprung up from nothing. I mean, I think about that as Americans. We almost feel like we sprang up from nothing. So without roots, we also have no responsibility to the future. I think we can see that ecologically as a rootless people. Uh-huh. Because we don't think what's coming down the line because we don't look about where we came from.
Isn't this an interesting point, though? Because it brings up profound moral questions. It's not simply a matter of not knowing where I came from, but it has social implications. And I think that is where, again, the baptismal liturgy says some things that are very important to us. The baptismal liturgy says very clearly that there is a community that pre-exists you. That in baptism you are enveloped into a pre-existing community. It's not that you gave birth to the community, it's that the community gives birth to you. One is brought into this pre-existing community that does have a history, that does have roots. Now, the truth of the matter is that many times that history is the history of sin. Not many times, all the time, it is the history of sin and grace, both. They interweave through the history of the Christian community, but we can't have any other kind of history than that kind of history. It is at least a history with ancestors, with a whole, isn't that part of what we mean by the communion of saints? Are these ancestors upon whom our gathering here in this place is predicated upon a pre-existing community that had a vision. And I'm not talking about a few people who got this place started. I'm talking about the immigrants who came from Europe, who established churches in the Northwest, who were able to support the foundation of this place. In other words, by our touching the stones of this place, the wood of it, we are touching the history of those who came before us. The other part of it is that when we gather in worship, we are engaged in an act of, to use an old Greek word, anamnesis. It's a take on the word amnesia. What is amnesia?
Forgetfulness
of
who you are.
Of who you are. Amnesia, the state of amnesia presupposes that at one point you knew who you were, but you forgot. And the goal is to learn or come to recognition of who you are. And amnesis, we gratefully remember who we are. That's the old word for the Eucharistic prayer, and it's the old word for the prayer of blessing over the water. Did you hear that? Were you, anybody at church last night?
Yes.
Come on.
Yes.
Did you hear the prayer of thanksgiving? I think Susan prayed it at the beginning. We offer you thanks, for in the creation you did this. With Israel, you did this. With Noah, you did this. With the exiles, you did this. Why do we say those things? To remind us that we have a history in which grace is more prevalent than sin.
and that God acts with us and through us in history. If we forget that history, what are we left with? Only ourselves. Only ourselves. We're left only with ourselves. That's why those two prayers are so important, the prayer over the water at baptism and the great prayer at the table. It is thanksgiving to God for our common history, because without that, we have no memory. Christian baptism, our time is up. Christian baptism says we are initiated into a community that loves memory and abhors forgetfulness. A community that loves its memory because its memory is its path into the future. Without that, we are wandering through the desert with no direction. What a wonderful way to end. Okay, we're done.